Hi, welcome to Colonial Williamsburg, past and present on history.org. This is Behind the Scenes.
Hi, welcome to the podcast. I'm Harmony Hunter, filling in this week for Lloyd Dobbins. And my guest today is Dr. Scott Stevenson, who is Director of Collections and Interpretation for the American Revolution Center at Valley Forge. And Scott is joining us today to talk about 18th century woven beadwork from the American Southeast. And Scott, I notice when you're describing this beadwork, you've used the phrase hidden in plain sight to describe it. Why?
Well, the story began really on the back of a polar bear in Scotland. To be completely honest, I was doing research in Scotland almost 20 years ago now. I was interested in the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War, as it's called, and was looking for letters that had been written from North America back home, sort of describing life in America and the conduct of the wars. Lots of Scots, of course, served in the British Army, came to North America, but kept in touch with their families. So it's a very rich source of description. And I just happened to go to this one house, a private home in Scotland, and was looking at the papers. And because I'm also very interested in material culture, just asked, well, you know, do you have any old things from America here? And so they brought me back into this sort of closet area, and there was literally an old stuffed polar bear on wheels that you could sort of wheel around. And then right behind it was a cabinet with some American Indian items, including a couple of these woven pieces, a garter and a broad sort of 5 foot long, very dramatic sash or belt that had been, you know, woven with thousands of these glass beads.
What did you think when that cupboard was opened?
Well, you know, you always get excited when you see sort of new stuff that hasn't been published before, new and Scotland, maybe it's because there's low temperature and low light, the preservation of these items tends to be remarkable. They were sort of collected as curios in the 18th century, and they have not suffered. You know, we have a lot of heat and humidity and insects here, particularly in the South in America, but in the North as well. And the things just don't survive in as good a condition. So some of these pieces just look like they'd been made yesterday. It was really remarkable. And what was the sort of aha moment was that same day seeing these items and realizing I just saw a reference to these in a letter written in the 1760s by an officer in the British Royal Navy talking about sending a sash and a pair of garters home to Scotland to be part of this sort of cabinet of curiosities. That started a whole— we could be here for 4 hours as I tell you all the serendipity and happy accidents along the way. But all of a sudden, this sort of constellation of objects that either through more research yielded direct evidence or sort of through association and circumstantial evidence, all of a sudden you could sort of draw a circle around this group of items that all appear to have been made before 1800 in the Southeast, you know, from sort of the Pensacola, St. Augustine area up into Cherokee country and over to the Mississippi. So it was very, very exciting.
So this is why it was hidden in plain sight. You just needed to assemble all of those clues and look at them through
sure.
One lens.
You know, so often the objects, the antiques or the artifacts, they become separated. You know, the first great separation, and perhaps the most tragic, is their separation from the native communities and cultures that produce them. And then the second separation is that they're often separated from the context that they've been cared for all these years, which often includes letters and information about where and when they were collected. So what would typically happen is these things would maybe there's a death in the family and an estate is settled, and objects like that will go off to an auction house somewhere, and they're sold as beautiful items of American Indian production, and they fetch very high value, you know, they fetch very high prices. But they're sitting, you know, sort of moldering away on old slips of paper in the closet is the actual documentation that tells you what this is or who collected or the clues to help plug these things together. And this happens sort of several times at key points in what became this project for me, is sort of encountering these collections still in the hands of the descendants of the original collectors with the documentation that allows you to knit it together. So then it made me, of course, realize that, oh, you know, how much do we really know about any of this stuff? So it's, you know, it's great, fun detective work, definitely.
You've used the term material culture a few times. What does that mean?
Well, it is really just about any item of dress or the type of domestic wares that you use in your everyday life. It's the expression of a particular culture through the material world, whether it's clothing, whether it's things that you cook in, the architecture that surrounds you, et cetera, et cetera.
So the physical surroundings of daily life.
Absolutely, yeah.
What are the objects that you found?
Well, they are a combination of garters, which are worn around the knee. They're worn in most cultures to keep socks up or to other garments in place. There are sashes that might be worn around the waist or over the shoulder. Also, small pouches. And what distinguishes these items is that they're constructed, their appearance is almost as if it's solid glass beads. So they're generally small, colored glass beads, white, black, a deep red garnet color, very common. And they're woven, so they become a kind of textile, but they're not woven on a loom. It's actually handwork, various techniques of hand weaving, of using often wool or fibers that are produced from native plants or things that are received through trade with Europeans, and glass beads. So again, a lot of quite a few items received in trade with Europeans, but then are combined together in a very unique native expression, artistic expression. They're really quite beautiful.
Are we talking about utilitarian items or ceremonial?
Well, it's difficult. I mean, we have to be careful in separating the secular and the spiritual, both for European cultures in the 18th century. I think we live in an era in which the separation of church and state is sort of taken for granted. So even for Europeans in the period, that may not have been a real distinction for many people. And I think it's fair to say, particularly in Native America, what's considered sort of utilitarian and ceremonial or spiritual may not be a real distinction. A lot of these items have really lost their cultural context because they, again, because like all cultures, native culture was not frozen in time. People changed, their material culture changed under the stresses of the colonial experience for native people and forced migration and amalgamation of different groups. You had new influences coming in, new types of items and clothing, fashion. So one of the reasons it's been difficult to recognize these pieces is because they, by and large, for most groups, stopped being made, say in the early 19th century, in favor of other types of decorative arts. And those became the sort of recognized tribal styles that you would often see, like if you went to Oklahoma today, and many of the distinct tribal styles of southeastern Indian peoples are not necessarily what you would have seen in 1750. You might have seen them in 1850.
Thinking about that cultural flux, what do the items that you found, what do they tell you?
One of the things that it really got me thinking about is connections between native people. And if you think about waterways not as barriers like we do today that have to be bridged, but as highways that connect people together, of course you can get on a river in Minnesota and go to Louisiana. And so the superficial resemblance between these things and the both in terms of the technique and the appearance speaks to the great connections between native people. They were not just living in sort of isolation, waiting to be encountered by Europeans, but that there was this sort of rich, interconnected world Europeans came into, and it really speaks to great connections and great cultural dynamism, really, in adapting new materials, making new items, interpreting old. Many of these have old designs that go back to pre-Columbian pottery and other art. So there's traditional aspects and innovative aspects as well.
What makes this beadwork so rare?
I think it's a combination of things. these items were often collected in the 18th century. And this is the era before sort of anthropology, before you are collecting items of human cultures with, for the purpose of documenting the lives and cultures of peoples around the world. They tend to be collected as curios, as they were often called savage curiosities. And there's not a lot of concern about who specifically, what specific group made this, what community did this item come from. It's just, it is an 18th century tourist item in a sense. I think you also have climatic issues, that just the survival rate of things in general, whether it's Euro-American or American Indian in the South, tend to not be as good as in colder climes. And that, you know, that would be my guess, that it's a combination of those things. But it, again, going back to the title, Hidden in Plain Sight, I do believe that there are probably lots of other items that are sort of miscataloged at the moment, that we may, in fact, have a much larger body of material culture for the native people of southeastern North America than we think we do.
That's our show for today. Our guest has been Scott Stevenson. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
That's Colonial Williamsburg, past and present this time. Check back often. We'll post more for you to download and hear. Send us a comment at history.org/podcasts.